me the voice of the people.
This is Wade Rathke. That means it's Friday morning. It's Wade's World, 9 to 9:30 a.m. Central Standard Time. We're broadcasting at www.kabf.org if you want to listen on live stream, or 88.3 FM on your dial. 100,000 watts of people power from Little Rock, Arkansas to the world. On Wade's World, every week we talk to the most interesting people in the world, and today we're lucky to be talking to Mark Ruccovina, who's the principal of Community Health Advisors. We've been talking about these hospitals and their deaths for some time. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Wade. It's a pleasure to be on Wade's World this morning.
Well, everybody knows what debt's all about, but this medical debt thing is something you've looked at for years, isn't it, Mark? Well,
yes.
Tell us about what Community Health Advisors is about.
Well, Community Health Advisors, I founded Community Health Advisors 3 years ago to work with nonprofit hospitals to help them comply with some new regulations that hospitals need to comply with in order to maintain their federal tax exemption. And those requirements in particular relate to providing financial assistance or charity care to people that have limited financial means in the communities that they serve, and to also have transparent billing and collection policies, generally to help people in need and not go after them aggressively for bills that they're unable to pay. Another component of these requirements is that hospitals conduct every 3 years, a minimum of every 3 years, a community health needs assessment to identify needs in the community, and then in exchange for the generous tax subsidies that hospitals are given in the form of a tax exemption, focus some of their resources on addressing selected needs identified through these community needs assessments. So that's what I've been doing for the past 3 years, and this work grew out of many decades of work, actually, advocating for improved access to care for uninsured and vulnerable populations. So this is a natural progression for me to see these rules that were included as part of the Affordable Care Act put into place in communities across the country to ensure that people are able to access a vital need, health care.
And medical debt is a huge piece of the credit and debt environment, isn't it, Mark, from your research and action?
Yes. Just recently we've got this new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that was established out of the Dodd-Frank legislation. And they last year they issued a couple of different reports focused on medical debt. And they found that tens of millions of Americans have medical debt on their credit report. In fact, more than half of all of the collections that appear on people's credit reports are medical in nature.
You know what surprised me about that report is, relatively speaking, how small the debts were when they ended up darkening people's credit.
Yeah, this is one of those situations where it's sort of a death by a thousand paper cuts. You know, you have people that have $25 copayments. They might have a deductible of $1,000. They have a string of healthcare visits. They have numerous bills associated with those copayments. If they've gone into a hospital, I'm sure many of your listeners know, you walk into the door of a hospital, out of the door of that hospital, and you can get bills from four or five different entities. You know, there might be a lab fee, some specialists have seen you, and the hospital bill itself. So each one of those can be a blemish on someone's credit report if it's not paid. And for many people, even when it's paid, it can be a problem because bills, for people with insurance, it can take weeks, months to figure out who's responsible for paying the bill. Is it the insurer or is it the patient? And if it takes too long, a provider can send that bill to collection. Once the bill's been sent to collection, generally speaking, it's reported to the credit bureau, so it ends up on your credit report, and that creates problems for people. And even if that bill is then subsequently paid, it can stay on your credit report and do damage for up to 7 years. So it's a real problem.
Say, in the big foreclosure crisis, which we're only recently starting to emerge from, medical debt was often the single biggest driver for bankruptcies and foreclosures for years.
Yeah, there's some pretty good research out there in terms of medical debt and the effect it has on personal bankruptcy. But it's also interesting to note, Wade, and I'm glad you brought this up, in terms of the home foreclosure counseling that was done. The number one reason for home foreclosures was, you know, loss of job or loss of income. But medical debt has consistently been a factor in about 6-8% of home foreclosures in the country. So, and that's over time. That was preceding the financial crisis of 2008 and since that time. So it is a problem that affects millions of Americans. Unaffordable health care costs or bills that end up on people's credit report and damage their credit. So you see a spillover effect. For people that have limited income, don't have adequate insurance coverage, who have medical needs, they can incur bills that they struggle to pay. And we see pretty consistently over time, and again, I used to provide direct service to individuals who had medical debt, and what we saw consistently was the following. People would try to pay their bills, and typically, you know, about 40% of people with medical debt exhaust their savings trying to pay those bills, but they still come up short. And then they do things that are risky. You know, they might borrow against their home, take some money out of their home through a refinance and pay a medical bill. Put it on credit cards if they have a credit card and run up the cost of that debt, increasing it by, you know, 25-28%.
Absolutely.
Because now they're paying interest on something that they were struggling to pay previously. People borrow from friends, from family. So, you know, they're and they deny themselves other needs. Trying to pay these medical bills, because especially people that have ongoing health care needs and a relationship with a provider, they want to preserve that relationship, you know? They want to be able to go and see that doctor the next time a need arises. So many people are embarrassed by the fact that they have medical bills, but, you know, the sad news is that there are tens of millions of people in America who are struggling with unaffordable health care costs. And so, you know, unfortunately, people aren't alone, but there are things that can be done. I think that the Affordable Care Act brings some new coverage options for people, either through, in the states that chose to, an expansion of the Medicaid program, or subsidized coverage that are offered through the health insurance exchanges or the health insurance marketplace. So people can get private coverage with some subsidy to cover the cost of that premium. That said, they're also going to be facing out-of-pocket costs. So in the form of deductibles or co-payments, there may be costs associated with care, even for people who do secure coverage under the health insurance marketplace.
And we don't want to even get into the issue before the Supreme Court about subsidies for so many of our states, and that includes states like, you know, throughout the South and some of the Western states, if the subsidies are pushed back because states didn't, you know, organize their own marketplace. And I know you've written about the fact that many people just plain don't go seeking health care when they need it because of the cost, don't they?
Right. No, cost is a major barrier. And I think that, the Affordable Care Act goes a great distance to addressing the issue of cost for millions of people. But I want to point out another provision, and that's what my central work at this point in time, another provision that was included as part of the Affordable Care Act, is that nonprofit hospitals, in order to maintain that federal tax exemption, establish financial assistance or charity care policies designed to help to help address some of those financial barriers to healthcare for people that might not have at the ready $500 for a deductible or $1,000 to cover, their deductible before the insurance begins to cover for the cost of the care. So I think this is an important part of the safety net going forward. Certainly, Medicaid is vitally important, and it's unfortunate that not all states chose to expand Medicaid. It would have helped millions of people in the states that chose not to do that. And hopefully the Supreme Court, and that's way above my pay grade, Wade, trying to predict what they're going to do, but hopefully these subsidies will stand and millions of people who've gotten coverage because of those subsidies, which has helped healthcare become more affordable to them, hopefully that will be preserved for them. But beyond
that's
7.5 billion
people, so it's not that's not a rounding error. But let's talk about the nonprofit hospitals, because that's where you're pretty much embedded. We've been looking over recent weeks at on this show at some of the sort of curious practices that we're running into. We've looked at the Heartless or Heartland Hospital in St. Joseph, Missouri, and talked to the ProPublica reporter there, and we've looked at some of the others. Some of their practices are pretty ruthless. I mean, owning their own debt collection agencies, taking people, garnishing people's paychecks for millions of dollars a year is. We're hoping this isn't common. What's your cut on how frequent this kind of all to the wall, aggressive, ruthless kind of debt collection is for nonprofits?
Well, there's thousands of nonprofit hospitals out there across the country, and I'd say there's a fair amount of variation by state. So there's sort of a state culture that comes into play. I live in Massachusetts. We've had on the books for many years some regulations regarding charity care and regarding credit or collection practices of hospitals. But in other states, there's been less state regulation of the hospital industry, and in particular the nonprofit hospitals, and maybe some of those practices have gone a bit too far. So again, that's what the federal regulations attempt to do, is to create a more clear and level playing field for nonprofit hospitals around the country. So what they're supposed to do is establish charity care, written charity care or financial assistance policies that clearly spell out the eligibility requirements. So, what level of income, what the income thresholds are to qualify for that coverage, and the kind of coverage that they might receive or assistance they might receive, whether it's free care or partially discounted care. So those are to be written and to made widely available to the public. The IRS, so the Affordable Care Act was passed nearly five years ago now, this month.
Yeah.
And the final regulations on these particular provisions related to nonprofit hospitals were just issued at the end of December last year. There was some proposed regulations. There was a lot of commentary, Wade, on these regulations when they were released, from consumer advocacy groups, from the hospital and healthcare industry, from the collection industry. They had hundreds of comments on the regulations. And I think that in the Department of Treasury and the IRS did a really good job of sorting through all those comments. There was also a public hearing held on the regulations related to charity care, and they came up with a final set of regulations in December that now make it clear what hospitals are required to do. And in those regs, they said transparency is critically important, and that was stated in the statute. That it's clear that hospitals need to establish these financial assistance policies and also explain to patients that are eligible for policies, the kind of actions that they might take in the event of non-payment of medical bills. So that's getting to the point that you're referring to, the garnishment of wages, et cetera. So what the statute said was interesting. It said hospitals should have these financial assistance or charity care policies, and the policy should spell out eligibility and the kind of assistance provided. It should be clear about how somebody applies, also clear about making them the policies widely available. So information for a nonprofit hospital, anybody, and anywhere in the country at this point in time, you should be able to go on a nonprofit hospital's website and find information on financial assistance or charity care. And going forward with these new regulations, hospitals will be required to post their actual financial assistance policy, a plain language summary of that policy, again, outlining criteria for eligibility and the kind of assistance provided and where to go to apply and who to contact for information on this, as well as an application. So all three of those things, the policy, an application, and a plain language summary of that policy should be available on a nonprofit hospital's website.
And then the question will be whether or not they follow the policy. Cause
that's right. So then compliance
come up in cases like the Heartland Hospital, which you know claims 200% of the poverty level. But let's talk about that. I mean, in some states, we were talking to a lawyer from Chicago, the head of the Sergeant Shriver Poverty Law Institute there, was telling us in Illinois, it clearly spells out that every policy has to be 200% of poverty income. Reading the one, a hospital here in Little Rock, St. Vincent's 990, they sort of comment about 200. They know that some people do that, but what they like is the HUD standard, which is closer to 120, 140. Is this a mixed bag? Are they going to be able to just pick anything they want to off the shelf and say that's what they want to see as poverty, or do you think that's going to go towards a clear standard?
Again, I think the goal here is transparency. The IRS, the regulations do not dictate where to set eligibility, but the policy should be clear where eligibility is set. Some states, like Illinois, do have laws, existing state laws in place. There are a handful of states across the country that have some sort of standards. But most don't. The vast majority don't. So it will be up to the hospital to set their eligibility standards for financial assistance. But again, you know, and I would encourage your listeners to ask the hospitals for their policy. Go on the website. See what the policies say. If they think the hospital's policies don't accurately reflect the need in the community, talk to the hospital. One of the provisions I mentioned earlier on community health needs assessment, in conducting these assessments, hospitals have to take input from medically underserved, low-income, limited English proficient populations. They need to consider that input in conducting that needs assessment and then in developing their health improvement plans that are addressing some of the needs identified in these assessments. And in many communities, Wade, the major barrier to care for people is financial. So if people feel that the policies aren't generous enough, raise that with the hospital and raise it in the context of their needs assessment.
I guarantee you we will, Mark.
and again, it's required that hospitals consider these comments that they get, written comments, comments they might get on a website on their needs assessment and on their policy. So, yeah, that's really important. That, you know, let's exercise rights here.
That's the handle for us. I'm glad we're talking about that.
Yeah, no. It's really important for people to understand that. So, you know, back to the issue of will there be a standard? No, it's unlikely we're going to see any sort of thresholds put out by the federal government on this. Maybe some states will do it. I'm sure there are other states that, you know, don't like to be heavy-handed with the regulations that aren't going to do it. So that's going to leave it up to you and your listeners to make sure that, you know, that the policies, again, reflect the needs of the community. But
I
think, you know, the first, you know, it's very important to have transparency around these policies so you know what they are. I mean, again, from my experience in the past, people didn't really know what the eligibility standards were. They'd send an application in, they'd get a letter back saying they didn't qualify with very little information explaining why. That should be addressed going forward, assuming that, you know, I think the vast majority of hospitals in the country are going to comply.
I hear you. I've got
regulations.
A technical question, and today on Wage World, we're talking to Mark Ruccovina, who's the principal of Community Health Advisors and a longtime expert and advocate in this field dealing with nonprofit hospitals. In looking at a lot of these hospitals, one of the things that is intriguing to me and a number of people that have started trying to really unpack this is how people try to count, how people, meaning nonprofit hospitals, deal with Medicaid and Medicare, whether or not they believe they're being fully reimbursed for their cost and how they are allowed or try to count some of what they believe is unreimbursed cost against their obligation as 501c3 nonprofits to provide care. Particularly, we were, fascinated or appalled, I don't know what the best word is, about a hospital we were reading, looked into in Boise, Idaho, that wanted to count like $18 million in what they saw as unreimbursed care, as if that were, pretty much they were paying, in their words, on their website, paying to provide Medicare assistance. What's the fair thing there? I'm sure you get asked this question by nonprofit hospitals. What's the rule of thumb? How should we look at that?
Well, I want to separate Medicare and Medicaid for a minute. So Medicare is a federal program that provides coverage to adult to people over the age of 65 and some people who've been disabled by Medicare standards for 2 years or more. So that's generally speaking a program for the elderly. And there's an advisory board that helps sets rates for Medicare. Members of that advisory board say that they believe Medicare rates are set at a rate that are reasonably efficient, that would cost a reasonably efficient provider to deliver the service. So I kind of want to take Medicare off the table. Though many hospitals still claim Medicare doesn't pay them adequately, there's some in the industry that would argue possibly if they were more efficient providers, they'd get paid appropriately by the Medicare program. Medicaid's a different story. Medicaid is a joint federal-state program. And we see that in the recent implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Some states opted not to expand coverage to low-income populations in their state. They felt it was heavy-handed of the feds to tell them they needed to do that. So, unfortunately for tens of millions of people across the country in states that chose not to expand Medicaid, they're left uninsured. Now, Medicaid typically is not, it's joint federal-state funding. State budgets are often pressed, and Medicaid rates are often depressed. So hospitals claim a shortfall in terms of their Medicaid. Now, you mentioned earlier, Wade, I want to come back to it. You mentioned a Schedule H, and that's a tax document. Nonprofits have to file what's called a Form 990. It's a nonprofit's tax return. And hospitals in particular have to file something called a Schedule H. And in that Schedule H, they report a number of different things. And again, for your listeners, I would encourage them to get the Schedule H of local hospitals and look at it, because there's a lot of very interesting information in there, including what they provide.
Shocking information, actually, Mark.
It's shocking. Sometimes it is, Wade. Sometimes it is shocking. But generally, you can see in there what hospitals claim they provided in charity care or financial assistance. And you can see what percentage of the revenues that the hospital generated through patient care that charity care constitutes. And there was just a recent report issued that showed that about 2% of, generally speaking, for nonprofit hospitals across the country, so there's a lot of variation in this, but about 2% of those patient revenues are given back in this charity care financial assistance. Then there's also a separate number in there, a couple of numbers. One is the Medicaid shortfall that we just talked about, and the other is a Medicare shortfall. But on that Schedule H, those numbers are on distinct lines, so you can see what's being done in terms of financial assistance or charity care, what's being done in terms of Medicaid, and what's being done in terms of Medicare. Also on that form, interestingly enough, is information on some of the collection practices of hospitals. So this is really going to be the reporting instrument for these new requirements for nonprofit hospitals across the country. And this is going to be important information for policymakers at the federal and state level, for groups at the local level, be it the local tax assessor or local advocacy groups, the media. This information is public information and available to anybody who wants to access it. I want to. Can I just comment on that collection actions a bit, Wade?
Let me ask you one question before you go there.
Okay.
So the IRS is going to be the sharp end of the stick here.
The IRS is the sharp end of the stick. Absolutely.
And we all know from the controversies over recent years that the nonprofit tax exempt side of the IRS has been depopulated by congressional funding action.
Right.
How are they going to be able to really supervise this? This is going to be a tough job.
It's going to be a tough job. They're going to be doing what are called bench audits. So they'll be looking at some of the paperwork that hospitals will be providing with them with to try to ensure that they're in compliance. The sanctions here are pretty serious. A failure to satisfy these new requirements could result in the loss of a federal tax exemption. And that's going to be based on what's called a facts and circumstance approach. So they're going to be looking at a number of different factors to determine whether or not they're willing to pull a hospital's tax exemption. That's a pretty high bar, and it's unlikely that there's going to be adequate staff to really review thoroughly the requirements. But certainly, this can be examined at the local level, and there are there's some provisions in terms of the failure to meet these requirements. There's sort of minor errors and omissions, but they require that hospitals take corrective action. So again, if you see something locally that doesn't seem right, if a hospital's policy doesn't seem to be followed by the hospital and its practices, raise that with the hospital administration. And, if the concern continues, I think that there's a probably an avenue to pursue right directly to the IRS on this. Because again,
as an organizer, I don't think I've ever been able to say I had the IRS, on my shoulder helping me out. So this could be unique. Look, I want you to be able to add the comment you. God, this has been a fast half hour. Add the comment you wanted to make because we didn't even get to the best practices yet. I may have to rope you in a couple of.
Oh, I'd love to come back
and do some more.
I'd love to come back on Wage World.
Tell me what comments you're about to make.
I was going to make some comments in terms of extraordinary collection practices. So what the statute said was that hospitals are prohibited from pursuing extraordinary collection actions prior to screening somebody for their financial assistance.
Right.
And in the final regulations, they identified a number of these extraordinary collection actions. And that includes reporting to the credit bureaus. It includes putting a lien on property, attaching a bank account, commencing a civil action against somebody, pursuing someone that would lead to their arrest, and garnishing wages. So all of these things are what are called extraordinary collection actions. Now, the really great thing, really, I think, important protection that's included in the final regulations is that these kinds of actions can't be taken for at least 120 days after that first invoice gets generated to the patient. So you go into the hospital, you get care, it may take a month for the first invoice to be sent to you. That's when that clock starts ticking, Wade.
Oh, I think they're pretty efficient at sending out that first bill.
maybe they are, but still there's 120 days. And then there's a 30-day notification period. So on day 91, they could send you that 30-day notice saying, on day 121, 30 days from now, we're going to pursue collection actions against you that may include garnishing your wages and reporting to the credit bureaus. So there'd need to be some warning. And then with that, they need to include a plain language summary and information on how to apply for financial assistance. So I think that this is going to help put people on notice that certain actions are taken and steps that they can take to avoid that kind of problem. So,
and organizationally, that gives us an intervention point where we can get the word out that people need help to apply for that kind of help. Maybe we can give them some assistance.
Right. Maybe your organization can give them some assistance or call on other nonprofits in the community to help with that or the hospital itself.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
We've been talking to Mark Ruccovina, who's been very helpful here in laying this out. He's with Community Health Advisors. Mark, as our time gets short here, if people have some questions directly for you, I know you have a website. How can they reach out?
They can reach out at www.communityhealthadvisors.com, and there's a form there they can fill out if they have questions. We'll happily respond to them. And, again, Wade, if you want to continue with a discussion on this topic. I'd love to be on the program again at some point in the future.
Well, that's a commitment. As soon as I can schedule you again, because I know you're busy and it's a wild world, but we were going to talk about best practices, and we're going to have more questions about this. Today on Wade's World, we've been talking to Mark Lacovina of Community Health Advisors. We're on AABF 88.3 FM, 100,000 watts of people power. We'll be on again next Friday. We have someone from the Action Network talking about another side of all these issues. This is Wade Rasky. Stay tuned to KABF. Thank you for Wade's World.
Radio in Central Arkansas. This is KABF 88.3 Little Rock, the voice of the people.
Profile America, Friday, March 6th. Seemingly out of nowhere, the issue of mandatory vaccinations has been in the news recently, particularly